From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The last time the U.S. and Cuba had full diplomatic relations, Audrey Hepburn was in theaters as Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's. A gallon of gas was 27 cents. Freedom riders were heading south to challenge segregation. And the Soviets sent the first human to fly into space. Many things are different now, and soon the U.S.-Cuban relationship will be too. In an announcement that came to much of the nation as a surprise, President Obama announced that the U.S. will reestablish full diplomatic relations with Cuba.
We will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries.
As you might imagine, this announcement was greeted with wildly different reactions, with some praising it as long overdue, others denouncing it as a capitulation to an oppressive regime. This hour, On Point, after half a century, a new chapter in Cuban-American relations. You can join us on air or online. What's your reaction to the president's move? The right move at the right time, or, as the most high-profile Cuban-Americans in Congress seem to think, a dangerous mistake? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We have a variety of voices, but we start with an analysis of what led up to all this from Alan Gomez, who covers Cuba for USA Today. He's based in Miami, Florida, and we reached him there. Alan, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So how did this start? We have to assume that President Obama initiated the conversation since Cuba's been calling for a normalization of relations for some time. How did this all start?
Well, apparently, without any of us knowing, about 18 months ago in the spring of 2013, the Obama administration, initiated high-level talks with the Cuban government. They, working through some intermediaries, they started arranging secret meetings. At first, they were meeting quite a bit in Canada, and the Canadian government was hosting those up there. Over time, they ended up having a final series of decisive meetings in the Vatican to kind of hammer out the final details of this. And so they've been working on this very quietly over the last 18 months and finally culminating in what we saw yesterday.
What's driving each side here? Why does Cuba want normalized relationships and why does the U.S.?
Well, the question about Cuba is a very difficult one. I mean, they have been for 50 years using the economic embargo on the island on the part of the United States, using the sort of antagonistic approach that the U.S. has taken to the island as sort of justification for what's going on down there, explaining away why they're so poor, why their economy is in shambles. So, you know, I think for them, you know, they've used that as an excuse, but at the same time, I think from their perspective, you know, That's a lot of money in the United States that could get down there that could really help things out. So there's that obvious imperative. From the U.S. side, I don't think it's so much economic. It's a nation of about 11 million people, incredibly poor right now. There's definitely all sorts of potential there once things open up. But I think it's more an attempt to really try another route to take down that Castro regime, to take down the communist government there. You know, they'll argue that it's been 50 years that we've been trying isolation that has not worked. They found other people like first Russia, then Venezuela, then China to support them in their economic, their difficult economic times. And so they're saying, all right, let's try something else. Let's try empowering the sort of the Cuban people, giving them more access to capital, giving them more access to resources that can help them sort of rise up on their own and kind of settle things on their own down there.
Well, let's hear from Cuban President Raul Castro. He said yesterday in a televised address that he welcomed the shift to normalized relations with the U.S. And this tape is courtesy of the BBC, and we'll hear their translation. Here it is.
Cuba reiterates its disposition to cooperate with multilateral organizations such as the United Nations, recognizing that we have deep differences fundamentally to do with national sovereignty, with democracy, with human rights, and with foreign policy. I want to stress our will to hold dialogues on all these subjects.
Just to clarify, I'm not sure that's the BBC's translation. It might be a state television translation. But what is he talking about there? Now, Alan, what are the issues that remain unresolved by this move?
I mean, when he's saying that, he means the economic embargo. I think there was a little bit of confusion yesterday. You know, folks thought that, you know, hey, we can all just run down to Cuba now as tourists and, you know, buy a property and try to start businesses down there, and that, you know, the walls had completely crumbled. That's absolutely not what happened. The economic embargo on the island remains. That was done by an act of Congress. For 30-some years, it was an executive order by the president, but Congress enacted that. Now, it would take another act of Congress to remove the full economic embargo we have on the island. What the president did is use his power, what he could do to kind of work around that a little bit. President Clinton was the first to sort of really allow for some sort of trade with the island. He allowed for food and medicine exports down to Cuba. And, I mean, we have an economic embargo on them. But in 2008, we exported $711 million down to Cuba in food and medicine. So what the president's doing is kind of using that kind of power to get more money and more people down there. But yeah, what President Castro was talking about was the idea that, hey, this doesn't change the fact that you still have an embargo on us.
Well, Alan, I'm going to ask you to stay with us because I'm sure there are many people who have questions about this, and I'm going to ask you to stand by throughout the hour. But now I'm going to bring in from Miami, Florida, Elaine Diaz-Rodriguez. She's a 2015 Nieman Fellow at Harvard University and a journalist and professor at the University of Havana. Elaine, welcome to you as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Good day.
And also with us from Miami, Florida, is Jaime Suchliki. He's director of the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies at the University of Miami, where he is also a professor of history. He is the author of Cuba, From Columbus to Castro. Jaime Suchliki, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Elaine, I'm going to start with you. Is this one of those moments where you're going to remember where you were and what you were doing when you heard this news?
Oh, my God, of course. I mean, I have been living in Boston since September because I got the Nieman Fellowship. And then I was traveling here to see my family here in Miami. And I wake up in the morning. I read the news. And I was waiting for Obama's public statement and Raul Castro's statement because people from Cuba were writing me through Facebook, Twitter, and Gmail. And I was just waiting, oh, my God. Let's just pray for the common sense. I cry so much when I hear they were open embassies and the reestablishment of the relationship between the two countries and all this means for the regular Cuban people and citizens.
You said cried. So you cried. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Why were you crying? What made you cry?
Oh, my God. All the people from my generation, we were born after 99. So we grew up in this hostile relationship between Cuba and United States, and almost every Cuban has family here in the United States. I have so many cousins, so much family here that came through in rafters in 1994. And for me, this is like huge because I have my family in Cuba, I have family here, and I think this will change the way we relate with each other, the change we see at the Cuban relationship at the very personal level from now to forever. I was telling someone just yesterday, oh my God, my kids will be born without a completely different environment. And that's huge for me in the personal level.
Just briefly before I get to Jaime, because I certainly want to hear from you too. What do you think the biggest difference will be that this will make? Do you think it's mainly within families? Or is it mainly kind of personal relationships or something else?
I think it will be different in all the levels. I mean, in political level, in the economical level, there are like different. I mean, Obama is announcing like different measures. And in the personal level, I mean, for everybody, for all the families in Cuba, will be different. We have like almost 2 million people from Cuba living here in the United States, from the second generation, third generation. And we have under so many regulations. Just last week, I received a letter from Bank of America, and they don't allow me to have a bank account here in the United States because of the regulation of OFAC. So, I mean, we have been under so many restrictions, and for all the Cuban people, it will be better in the personal level and also in the political level.
Okay, Jaime Suchliki, what about you? Do you mind telling me where you were and how you reacted when you heard?
I cried also. Mm-hmm. But I cry because Cuba is not offering the United States any concession. The United States is giving unilateral concessions to a regime that has been an enemy of the United States, that oppresses the Cuban people, that is an ally of Iran, Venezuela, that supports terrorism throughout the world. So I think that the president could have and had an opportunity to extract concessions, real concessions, from Cuba at a very difficult moment for Cuba and let it go. And he's unilaterally, like he did in Iran, like he did in Russia, failing. And now he's trying to do the same in Cuba, offering an olive branch. Raul Castro will send him a thorn, not another olive branch.
What's your worst fear about this? Jaime, what is it that you fear that this will lead to? What is your worst case scenario here?
Well, the worst case scenario is that we continue to give concessions to Cuba, that the Cuban government will pocket those concessions, that they will get more tourism, more money, that the Cuban military will enrich itself because they own the cigar factories, the rum factories, and the hotels, and that the Cuban people will get nothing. The regime will remain an abusive, totalitarian, human rights violator. And then what have we accomplished? I don't think that's going to happen, because I think the Congress is going to take a very strong stand against what the president has done yesterday and demand that Cuba make changes before we make any concessions.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about yesterday's announcement that the U.S. will resume, after half a century, full diplomatic relations with Cuba. You can join the conversation. Is this the right move at the right time, or should the U.S. have continued to keep its distance? We've been speaking with Alan Gomez, who covers Cuba for USA Today. Also with us, Elaine Diaz-Rodriguez. She's a 2015 Nieman Fellow at Harvard University and a journalist and professor at the University of Havana. Also with us, Jaime Sutliki. He's director of the Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at the University of Miami and author of Cuba, From Columbus to Castro. Before we took our break, and just before we do that, I just want to play a short clip. There was a brief interview that Democratic Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico had with Fox News, and he said that normalizing relations with Cuba is an opportunity to spread democracy. Here he is.
I think if we send our people down there, our values will shine. I think Cubans will see what we stand for, and I think that will help engender democracy in that country.
Jaime Sutliki, what about that?
Well, first of all, Cuba has had 2 million tourists from Latin America, from Canada, from Europe, many of them that speak Spanish. In the last year alone, we haven't seen any democracy or any change. To think that an American from Iowa that doesn't speak Spanish is going to arrive in Havana with a magic wand and influence Cubans is naive at best.
Well, what's your evidence that 50 years of embargo has achieved the results that you seek? And that's the primary argument that the president made in his announcement,
one,
that the policy just isn't working.
The embargo is not the cause of Cuba's economic problem. The cause of Cuba's economic problem is a government and a system that doesn't work, like the Eastern European system didn't work, and like Soviet Union communism didn't work.
But that's not my question. Forgive me. That's not my question. My question is, what's the evidence that the policy is working to weaken the regime?
If you give me a chance, I'll answer it.
Okay.
So the embargo is a moral position, a moral position against a government that confiscated American properties, introduced nuclear missiles in Cuba, has been a supporter of anti-American regime, and has supported the worst terrorist groups in the Middle East. That is what the embargo is all about. And the embargo has to be changed in return for concessions from the part of the Cuban government. Change internally, freedom for the Cubans, access to the internet, freedom of the press, not unilaterally by the United States. You don't give unilateral concessions and hope for the best in the future.
Jaime, would you take a question from a caller? We have
sure.
some callers who have some questions for you.
Sure.
Okay, Mauro is calling from Iowa City, Iowa.
Yes, yes, Michelle. Yes, Jaime, llamo de Iowa y hablo bien el español.
Okay, well, there you go. Mauro says, I live in Iowa and I speak Spanish, so there you are.
I do a little Spanish, too, in Miami.
And I just came back from Havana 2 days ago. There is a lot of changes that are needed in Cuba, no doubt about it. I am a strong believer that the best way to change things is to open relations. Here, I went to church there 3 times. I was there 3 weeks. I was there 3 times. Nixon went to China in 72. Shortly after that, relations opened with China and Vietnam and so on. Excuse me. Now, tell me, how many times can you go to church in China? You have the Falun Gong, the Muslims, the Christians, all being persecuted. I want you to go to Havana, and you can go to it at any church you want. There's a lot of talk about bad things, and there are not so good things happening. But I think we have to look at a broader view of what how American implications go in relation to, as far as Colombian guerrilla wars, Brazil relations that have soured. The whole Latin American has fallen out with the U.S. in great part because of Cuba.
Okay.
So there's a lot more to talk about Cuba than just a narrow view of airplanes that were shut down in Cuban airspace 20 years ago and you know, personal relations and so on. So we have to look at a much broader perspective on this issue.
Okay, Mauro, thank you for that. And just Jaime, just to add another bit to this, we're getting a number of people writing to us on Facebook and Twitter saying,
good,
just as part of Mauro's point here, which is that Adam Birnbaum, for example, is one example. He says it never made sense that we embargoed Cuba while maintaining relations with the USSR, China, Vietnam, Saudi Arabia. And so what's your take on that?
Can I try to answer that?
Yeah, let's hear that. Yeah.
Okay. Look, the relationship with China has to do with a lot of things. It had to do with, number one, of a willingness of the Chinese to change, to accept foreign investment, to negotiate with the United States. Second, it had to do with the strategic interest of the United States at the time of the Vietnam War to separate China from Russia. And third, it had to do with the possible investments and potential of China as a major power. This is not the case of Cuba. Raul Castro is not saying, I'm willing to change, I'm willing to accept investments, I'm willing to allow the Cubans to get into business with American companies. He's not saying that. He's saying, and he said it yesterday again, that he has to defend the sovereignty of the revolution and that the revolution is not going to change. That doesn't mean that he's ready to make concessions. That means that Cuba remains what it has been for a number of years.
Let's hear from Ivan, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Ivan, welcome to On Point. What's your point of view on this?
My point is, before I address that point, my point is this is a moot point because in 1996, under our Republican president, Bill Clinton, and the House totally dominated by Republicans again. So what happens is that there is a law in there that, or a clause that states that the president cannot take and impose an individual action that basically repeals the law. So basically, when the Republicans come into the majority again, this is only a short-lived measure that is going to be canceled. So by the way, the policy has been extremely successful. We have prevented Cubans from buying into our terrible consumerism. We have prevented Cubans from creating class divisions. We have prevented Cubans from attacking us. So, you know, I think the policy has been fantastic. I mean, look at China.
Okay. Ivan, let's let Alan Gomez, would you answer that? I mean, Ivan makes a couple of points here, but his argument is that this is short-lived. When Republicans take over the Congress in January, that they will reverse these measures. Do you think that that's true or possible?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that they're going to try. So many. First off, there's the idea of just Congress's power of the purse. There are a lot of the things that the president is trying to do will require funding, and so they're gonna try to do that very soon. Many of the Republicans who have been upset with this have already yesterday were already screaming that they were going to be trying to do that very early in the new Congress. As to the question whether he can do it, I think you know there's so much of this. He's making so many broad changes from you know these. kind of high-level diplomatic talks that we're talking about, but all the way down to the idea that Americans are going to be able to use their debit card and credit cards in Cuba. There is definitely some power by the president to sort of expand these things. As I mentioned before, President Clinton expanded the possibility of aid and of food and medical sales down to the island, and we trade in the hundreds of millions every year with Cuba or export to them. So there's definitely some wiggle room there, but yeah, they're definitely going to be kind of reaching into every part of this broad plan that the president has proposed to see what of it they can stop.
Elaine, I'm interested in how you react to Ivan's points when I asked how we were talking about whether the embargo has worked, and he said it's prevented Cuba from creating a consumer culture, and it's also kept Cuba from attacking the U.S. And I was curious about your reaction to that. Elaine?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay.
I was missing you. Thank you. Well, yeah. Welcome back.
That's a tough question, but I think the embargo has done anything good with Cuba. I mean, we are preventing people from this consumerism, but come on, that's not a... I mean, that's not the what we are discussing here. That has prevented people from Cuba and Cuban authorities or... and the economy to improve. And I have a friend who also said that the embargo, the Cuban embargo, is the best friend to Cuban environment. But I have met so many people from United States, biologists and people working on Cuba and coral reefs, and they said this is beautiful and Cuba needs support from United States to keep it that way. I mean, to keep it in the healthy way, because we don't have the resource. So with the help of United States, we can improve our economy. We can improve a lot of things, and we will have like so not good things for our country too. But that's what exchanging with other countries means too. So. I don't think it's like black or white. I think we have to find a middle point where the two countries get what they want and they establish relationships.
Let's bring another voice in the conversation from New York. Ted Henkin is chair of sociology and anthropology at Baruch College. He's a former president of the Association for the Study of the Cuban Economy and writes the annual report for Freedom House on Cuba. He's co-author of Entrepreneurial Cuba, The Changing Policy Landscape. Ted, welcome to you as well.
Very nice to be here, especially with your esteemed guests.
Well, thank you for that, and welcome to the conversation. What about some of the points that we've raised here so far? I'm interested in your take on what is the U.S. getting out of this? What is the U.S. interest in changing the relationship? And I'm also interested in your perspective on Jaime's point that the embargo has been an effective tool.
Well, what is the U.S. getting out of it? I think what's important here to remember is that the United States, the Obama administration, and Obama yesterday justified these actions as in the interests of the American people primarily, so in U.S. interests, and secondly, in the interest of the Cuban people. And I think that's important to remember. People have criticized the measures as reaching out and embracing Raul Castro or embracing communism. And I think that that's exactly not what's happening here. It is principled engagement. What is the U.S. getting out of it? I think, first of all, the U.S., it's a strategic decision. Jaime made a good argument that this is a moral position. And I respect that. And many Cubans I know in the island, dissidents and others, share that position. But there's also a moral argument to be made for principled engagement, because that can produce positive change. Also, there's a moral argument to be made against the embargo, as it does make life harsher and harder for everyday Cubans. I think that the moral argument can cut both ways. I also think that the engagement is a strategic decision based on a pragmatic idea that our policy has not resulted in achieving American interests and goals in Cuba, nor has it helped Cuban people and Cuban dissidents to get a voice, to make space. And in fact, our policy could be argued that it's had the opposite effect. By putting pressure, heightening the temperature in Cuba, it actually makes less space for dissent, because dissent is seen as treason on the island. And with bringing down the temperature, the United States doesn't look like the big bad wolf that's going to eat up Cubans. And therefore, there could be some oxygen and some space for civil society to flourish further. It's already been flourishing a lot over the last or so years, people taking advantage of the small openings.
Let's take a couple of more calls before we have to let a couple of our guests go. Lou is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Lou, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi. What's on your mind? What's your perspective on this?
I was a student back in 2009 and had the opportunity to spend a bunch of time in Cuba, about 3 months, working with people, specifically in the scientific world there. I am in big support of what the president's doing. I believe that it allows business people in Cuba who are not only independent, but from my experience, incredibly intelligent and well-educated to start to stand on their own.
Do you have any family ties to Cuba, Lou, as well?
I do. I'm a Cuban-American. My mother is a refugee, and she came when about 10 years old back in 1962.
I'm curious about, and Jaime, I'm interested in your perspective on this, too. I'm wondering if, you know, the split on this is not strictly partisan. I mean, we heard Senator Robert Menendez from New Jersey, a Democrat, also very critical of this. And we've heard, Republican Senator Marco Rubio, extremely critical of this. And I wonder if is there a generational divide here? Because it isn't strictly partisan. Lou, what's your take on that? And I'm also going to ask Jaime about that. Lou?
You know, I absolutely received some serious resistance from my own family in deciding to spend time in Cuba and to travel there. I know that, you know, my family and their history and their story is sort of being pulled away from their land and their houses and their property and coming to the States with almost nothing and rebuilding. And so that's a very deep pain for them. I experienced some small amounts of that residually, but for me, the experience of actually seeing, getting to know Cuba and Cubans, it's a gorgeous country. It is full of so much energy, intelligence. The people are amazing that I think that us opening up back up to Cuba will only be beneficial for both sides.
Jaime, what do you think about that?
Well, I think most Cubans almost unanimously would like to see a change in Cuba and a democratic Cuba. There are some that believe that through normalizing relations and to trying to reach out, engagement, if you want to call it, we're going to achieve that objective. Others feel that we should wait till there is a change in Cuba and there is a regime that we can negotiate with and then offer them all kinds of concessions and not give away the concessions now. I don't know if it's generational. I teach some students that are as conservative as their parents, and I teach some students that are very liberal. So it depends on their education, background, experiences, etc.
The polling indicates that there's been a very large shift in public opinion on this, both in the U.S. at large and among Cuban Americans in particular. I'm citing here the 538.com. It's a polling site that gathers and does polling on a number of these subjects. It says that the American public overall has grown more favorable in recent years. Going back to 1999, Gallup has found that more Americans have in favor of ending the embargo than continuing it, and that just polling among Cuban Americans specifically, that on the Cuban Americans have in the past favored maintaining it overwhelmingly. Now, a slight majority oppose the embargo. Jaime, does that influence your thinking at all, or what do you make of that?
Well, I understand the American change. The Cuban change is not accurate. The Cubans continue, I don't know what the polls are saying, but they continue to vote for Ileana Roslathanen. They continue to vote for Mario Diaz-Balart. Recently, there was an election to Congress. Congressman Joe Garcia, a Democrat, was kicked out, and a Cuban, very conservative young man, Carlos Curbelo, became the congressman from South Florida.
And so President Obama also won Florida. And that, as I understand the polling, that the Cuban-Americans slightly favored Charlie Crist in the last election, even though he didn't prevail overall.
Yeah, but it's got nothing to do with the embargo.
Okay.
I mean, the Cubans vote, like any American vote, for economic issues, for health issues, and other issues. Not only the embargo, that's not the only issue that the Cubans vote on.
Okay. All right. I appreciate your participation. Jaime Suchliki is director of the Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at the University of Miami and author of Cuba, From Columbus to Castro. Jaime, thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing your insights. Elaine Diaz-Rodriguez is a Nieman Fellow, journalist, and professor at the University of Havana. Elaine, thank you so much for joining us as well. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the U.S., Cuba, and a new era in diplomacy between these two nations. You can join the conversation. What will the president's move mean for Cuba? Do you see this having a big impact in the U.S.? We're speaking with Alan Gomez, who covers Cuba for USA Today, and with Ted Henken, chair of sociology and anthropology at Baruch College and co-author of Entrepreneurial Cuba, the Changing Policy Landscape. So let's go back to first, I think it is important to establish that, you know, Jaime is not the only person who has strong feelings about this. This is an issue that evokes very strong feelings. I mean, at the news conference yesterday, Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida called the Obama administration decision, you know, profoundly disappointing in pretty strong terms. Let's hear a little bit of that.
It is a victory for the oppressive Cuban government, but a serious setback for the repressed Cuban people. The White House has conceded everything and gained little. They gained no commitment on the part of the Cuban regime to freedom of press or freedom of speech or elections. No binding commitment was made to truly open up the internet. No commitment was made to allowing the establishment of political parties or to even begin the semblance of a transition to democracy.
So, Alan Gomez, I wanted to ask you a question I was asking some of our guests earlier, which is, what are the fault lines here? It sort of has a partisan overlay, but it's not strictly partisan. And it seems generational, but not strictly so, since, of course, Marco Rubio is part of the latter generation of Cuban-American politicians. Where do you think the fault lines are on this?
I mean, you can identify a couple of them. I mean, I think there is without question a really significant generational divide. If you were somebody who had your home taken away by the Castro regime, if you spent time in a prison down there, if you were any number of the hundreds of thousands of Cubans that were down there during the period where the Castro regime took over, I mean, it is incredibly personal for you. I mean, I just talking with so many of them around here just in the last couple of days, it's real genuine sadness for a lot of them. They've been trying to fight this for so very long, and they kind of view this as sort of the final capitulation. There's many of them that described it a backstabbing by Obama, things like that. The younger ones, I mean, if you didn't live in it, it's totally different. It's something you read about. It's something you heard about, you know, at the kitchen table. It's something you kind of saw on TV, heard about. I mean, so it's not as personal, and I think it's a little bit easier for them to take a step back and try to look at it through a more objective lens. When it gets to the politics of it, that's when things change a little bit. The Cuban-American community is about 1.2 million down here in South Florida. They vote at a much higher rate than the other Americans. They contribute to political parties at a much higher rate than the average American. And because of that block, and because they were so traditionally Republican for so many years, I mean, the first presidential campaign, especially for a Republican candidate or a Democrat, was to come down to South Florida, have some Cuban coffee, and promise that you're going to uphold the embargo. So that kind of gave this community this outsized political influence. And in an incredibly important swing state like Florida, that's helped kind of maintain that base of opposition.
What about, we haven't talked to Ted Henken, one of the things we have not talked about at this point is the prisoner swap. I mean, Alan Gross, who was a contractor and also apparently an American intelligence asset who has not yet been named, were swapped for three Cuban spies who were convicted and incarcerated in the U.S. and then will be exchanged. This is something that has been sought for both. As Alan Gross, apparently his health was deteriorating and his family is very concerned about his well-being. But others are making the point that Marco Rubio made this point, that this increases the value of U.S. hostages around the world, that this sends a terrible message to repressive regimes around the world. What's your perspective on that?
Well, first, let me weigh in on the idea of the cleavage. I think one of the things that we can look at in terms of where people fall out on this cleavage, to the extent that, like Jaime Szczucki, you see this simply or very clearly as a moral and maybe personal issue, I think you may cut one way. Whereas I think the other argument and the other kind of cleavage or the other side of that cleavage is if you see it really as a pragmatic or strategic issue. Those who favor this new approach don't sell it as being nice to the Cuban government and don't understand it as capitulation. They understand it as changing a strategic, pragmatic decision that will, they hope and they expect, have a different outcome that will be in the benefit of the Cuban people. So I think that That might be, you know, the way that you see this, because I know many, many Cuban Americans, for them it's a personal, it's a moral stance, even though they know, and you'll see this in the polling, you ask Cuban Americans, has the embargo worked? They'll say no. Do you want the embargo? They'll say yes, because for them it's a matter of principle and morality and standing up. And also it's a matter of who's going to win the war. Is it going to be Castro? Many people see Obama as declaring defeat and letting Castro win, whereas I would argue that what Obama is doing is not about winning and losing. It's about coming to the table so the Cuban people and American people can declare victory, you know, so it helps the people on the ground in Cuba and in the United States.
I do want to bring in a few more calls, but I did want to ask Ted if you feel comfortable addressing the kind of broader regional question. For example, you know, Venezuela is a Cuban ally and has a regime, a government in place that many people consider to be autocratic at minimum and a dictatorship at worst. Even though the kind of charismatic Hugo Chavez is no longer in power and his successor doesn't seem to have quite the same kind of hold on public imagination that he did. But what does it have regional implications that difficult and concerning? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think that they're actually mostly positive, the regional concerns of what this happened. You asked me at the beginning mm-hmm. of the show or at the half hour, you asked me about what are the U.S. interests and how are they being served. I think one of the things that's in the bigger picture is that this will symbolically send a huge kind of repercussions and improve the U.S. standing all throughout Latin America. When Obama gave his speech, he said two things very clearly in Spanish. No es fácil, he said, it's not easy, describing the situation of an everyday Cuban who's struggling to survive and saying these methods and these changes are aimed at helping Cubans have a little bit easier time in their life, not to struggle so hard. The other thing he said was, todos somos americanos. And that was a message sent not to Cubans, but to everyone in Latin America to say that we are all Americans and that we all benefit from this and a better and engaging Cuba is a better approach than what we've had. And so I think symbolically that's going to, and we're coming up on the Summit of the Americas in April in Panama, that's going to be a hugely positive shot in the arm for relations among the hemisphere, because Cuba, even though it's not economically important, it's politically hugely important, and it's kind of a litmus test. And the United States virtually stands alone in its approach in the hemisphere towards Cuba. Even though the United States has positive relations with most of the other governments, those governments criticize and vote against the United States and its approach to Cuba.
Let's hear from some more callers who want to add some other points of view here. Alex is calling from Scituate, Massachusetts. Alex, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks. I have a couple of points. I've been to Cuba a few times, and I think what Obama's done is excellent, because even if the Congress does not lift the embargo, which they probably won't do, he's made another gesture, like the immigration policy he just put forth, to reach out and make a better relationship. And over time, Cuba will come around and become democratized. The Cubanos are very entrepreneurial. They're very hard workers. They want to get, you know, they want to be rewarded for their effort. Anyways, my point is also, that's one point. The second point is Cuba has an excellent opportunity right now when this happens, and they're already doing it, to have organic agriculture continue and ecotourism to hopefully flourish, because they haven't been developed and they're so near to such a developed and country like the United States, and hopefully they don't become like Miami Beach in 50 years. So I think Cuba has an excellent opportunity, and at high levels I'm sure they talked about all these things about democratization, but these will happen in time. So I'm very happy. Thank you. Off the air. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, thank you, Alex. Sammy is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Sammy, what's your perspective on all this?
Hi. How you doing? Hi, Michelle.
Oh,
and
hi.
You had a guest on there who, I think, Alan, and he hit it right on the nail, where he said that it's the kids, the millennial generation, that can sit back and actually understand it. I'm Haitian Cuban, so my mother and my father were both refugees when they came here, and their perspective is, they hold grudges a lot, and I think the older Cubans are basically just holding this big grudge, and they really want somebody to pay for what happened. Hmm. Versus, like, my generation is able to step back and see what is really going on and the benefits of it. You know, so I think that's really what's going on here.
Have you had a chance, Sammy, do you mind, have you had a chance to talk to your folks about this, if they're still with us? And have you had a chance to get their perspective on this change?
Oh, my father's outraged. You know, he's like, he feels somebody should pay, you know, for what happened in the past, for what Fidel did, mm-hmm. basically. And that we are overlooking and we're giving the old people a free pass. But I believe that the president is looking past that. This is why we get somebody, a leader, you know, that will look past emotions and look into the future and make decisions based on that. And I believe that my grandkids will benefit from whatever happens today.
Why do you think they will?
Because eventually, I believe that once money starts pouring into Cuba, their government will say, hey, we are benefiting from this big lift. We should do more so we can get more. And I believe it will probably set places where Americans can go there or mm-hmm. Cubans can come back and forth and things like that. I think it'll open up the air.
It's interesting that, and you didn't mention your mom. Do you mind if I ask, does your mom have a different perspective? Where is she in this story?
They're all still in Miami. She's Haitian. So when she was escaping from, you know, Haiti, it was a baby doc. You know, so she understands where my father is coming from. Hmm. But it's more home for my father than it is my mother. She's just supportive.
Well, Christmas dinner is going to be an interesting conversation for you all, so I wish you well with that. So, Sammy, thank you so much for calling. He raises some his interesting points, and Alan, I want to pick up just on one. We talked a little bit, Ted was talking about the regional questions. There's been a very different policy toward Haitian refugees and Cuban refugees or Cuban would-be migrants. And you have to wonder whether this will change. I know I'm asking you to speculate, which is unfair, but is there any way in which this might be changed immigration policies? Any thought about that? I know it's a source
Yeah, you know, one of the other very unique things about Cuba is our immigration policy towards them. Unlike every other country, if you are a undocumented immigrant, an illegal trying to get into the country, Cubans are the only ones that have to just basically touch land and they're good. Every other Latin American country, they have to, you know, go through this incredible ordeal that we see every day, and it's created this incredibly difficult immigration system. So, you know, talk about like long-standing policies that are just incredibly unique to Cuba. This is absolutely one of them. It's referred to as wet foot, dry foot. And basically, yeah, you touch ground, you make it here, you can stay in the country, you can get residency, you can become a U.S. citizen eventually. I can't imagine they're really going to delve into that. I think, you know, the folks who are really focused on Cuba policy, like from Senator Rubio to other Republican leaders, they're going to be very busy in these next few months trying to dismantle everything the president has done. I just can't really envision this being a time where they say, oh, and by the way, let's update sort of our immigration policy or that mm-hmm. stance for Cuban immigrants.
Ted, we're down to our last couple of minutes, and a number of our callers have suggested that Congress will be interested in taking this up when they arrive in January, head to Washington in January with kind of a very different political landscape. What would your message to Congress be when it does talk about this issue?
You're asking me.
Yes,
right?
Ted. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Well, my message would be that we should let these changes play out. I don't know that message will be heard by the Congress because they're very empowered and they feel like they have a mandate. And this is going against what they feel largely is their mandate. But I think that, you know, there's going to be 2 years, and I don't think they're going to be able to really take much of the wind out of Obama's sails on this. I think the administration has the right and the power illegally to do a lot of things that it did. There's going to be wrangling over the details, but I think that we'll really see after 2 years and then the presidential election if this new policy has had concrete, pragmatic implications that help the Cuban people as it's being sold to us to do on the ground in Cuba, that will be the test to see if, and we will see this argued over in the presidential, or lead up to the presidential election 2 years from now. And so I would say that we should see if these changes, the principled engagement economically, in terms of entrepreneurship, in terms of internet. I mean, Rubio was talking about how we gave away the farm, but there's actually many ways where we're actually reaching out to the Cuban people to empower them to be the authors of their own destiny. I don't think that the United States is in the position to demand concessions from the Cuban government. The Cuban people should be the ones demanding concessions to the Cuban government. So Cuba and the United States opening up to each other is great, but the Cuban government is now under the gun to open up to its own people, to listen to them. And I think our position now puts us in a better position to pressure, along with the European Union, that outcome.
Interestingly, we don't have time to talk about this, but interestingly, we've had a number of people writing in and calling, expressing concern that the consumer culture will not be an asset to Cuba in the years ahead. So that's going to be an interesting conversation as well. That was Ted Henken. He's chair of sociology and anthropology at Baruch College and co-author of Entrepreneurial Cuba, The Changing Policy Landscape. Ted Henken, thanks so much for speaking with us.
A great pleasure.
Alan Gomez was also with us. He's a reporter for USA Today. He covers Cuba. Alan, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, Cuba Reset, Russia's ruble troubles, the school massacre in Pakistan, and Jeb Explores 2016. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.